Welcome to Tentpole Trauma, the podcast where we look at movies that came with hype and high hopes, but left with crushing disappointment, either critically, at the box office, or both. Freed from the weight of expectations, we seek to examine these underperformers under a new light, parsing through the good, the bad, and everything in between with the hopes of gaining a better understanding as to why they failed to find their audience. Warning, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie that we're discussing today, I suggest you stop the podcast and go watch it. Then when you come back and listen, you'll get more out of the discussion. On this episode, we discuss Blowout. Okay, I am Sebastian, and I'm here with Jennifer.
Hello.
We are doing a Just the Two of Us episode, and this is a special episode because this is a by request episode.
Ooh.
We say that if you want to throw out a suggestion for a tentpole trauma to cover on the show, we will happily take your suggestion under serious consideration and most likely do it. This one comes to us from our listener, Paul Natal, of the famous Massachusetts Natals. I may be pronouncing Paul's last name wrong. It may be Natali, but I don't know for sure how his name is pronounced, even though I've known him for a while, for many years.
Well, if you don't know, then I don't know.
Who knows the way those Italians pronounce things?
All we know is that we like Paul, and Paul has really good taste in movies. And if Paul suggested something, we're going to make it happen.
That's right. And the movie he suggested was Brian De Palma's 1981 neo-noir thriller, Blowout. Now, this was a fortuitous request because you are a big fan of this film, are you not?
I am a big fan of this film. I'm a big De Palma fan up to a point.
I am also a big De Palma fan. And this is really kind of the sweet spot of De Palma.
That's right.
In my opinion. Because this is coming right after Dress to Kill, which I know we both like a lot.
Big time.
And I feel like this movie bears some similarities to Dress to Kill, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. I mean, for one, having Nancy Allen back again, kind of, I mean, she's not blatantly a prostitute in this, but kind of in that same world.
Yeah.
For sure. And it just has that same vibe. And Dennis Franz is also back from Dress to Kill. And then, well, John Travolta and Nancy Allen from Carrie.
That's right.
So, yeah, a lot of familiar De Palma faces.
Indeed. Now, before we get into our discussion on Blowout, we should say that Blowout is very famously a sort of remake of Michelangelo Antonioni's Blow Up from 1966. The mediums have been changed. Both films involve a artist who uses technology in their work, and that technology reveals a murder. I would say the Antonioni film is much more concerned with other things other than telling a murder mystery.
Yeah. If you are going to watch Blow Up and you're in a murder mystery mood, you're going to be a little disappointed with the murder mystery element of it.
Yes, both films were available easily to us on HBO Max, so we just decided last night we'd watch them both, because why not? So we could do a little bit of discussion of Blow Up beforehand. And, you know, I had seen Blow Up, I think, years ago. You'd seen it too, right?
I had too. I think I saw it when working at Cinephile, something like that. I mean, I just knew it was a film that I should check out. But when we were talking about this, I'm like, I've seen Blow Out way more times than I've seen Blow Up. Like, I'd seen Blow Up like once. And then last night, now it's two times where I've seen Blow Out many, many times. And there's a reason why.
Yeah, I'd like to keep it that way. Now, this is going to be an unpopular opinion, especially amongst film buffs that may be listening to this. I know that Blow Up has a really sterling reputation. And I will say this about Blow Up. I can see what people who like it like about it. It is really not a murder mystery.
No.
As we were pointing out in the beginning of the episode, the photographer, as played by David Hemmings in Blow Up, doesn't even realize he's photographed a murder until halfway through the movie, because most of the movie is just him going around living his freewheeling 60s swinger sort of life. And it's really about swinging 60s London at the time. And it's sort of funny to watch, I think, now, because I think the things that we're seeing through our more modern lens don't seem very radical at all. In fact, he just seems like a prick. Like, I think maybe at the time that character might have been seen as kind of cool and edgy, but he's just kind of like borderline problematic, treats women really badly. He's really pushy and kind of sexually aggressive in a mm-hmm. way that's really unattractive to a modern lens, I think. There's cool shit in it. Like, at one point, he wanders into a Yardbirds concert at a club, and Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck, mm-hmm. RIP, are both there on stage. And, you know, it's got a style for sure. But if you're in it for a compelling murder mystery, look elsewhere.
Yeah, it's definitely a vibe. I get, as you had just said, like how it would have been pretty radical for its time. As far as David Hemmings is this fashion photographer, and he's living this really kind of bohemian life and just freewheeling, and he's super cute. Like, this is like probably the cutest you'll ever see David Hemmings looking on camera, because I think, you know, he got a little stockier, and, you know, I think you were saying his last film was Gladiator.
One of his last films.
Yeah. And he was, I mean, you kind of wouldn't recognize him from that. I mean, he aged as we do, as humans do. But this is like catching him at a really good, handsome time. You don't like to be that, you know, judgy of how things were then and what was acceptable then, because that was then. But yeah, it's just kind of, he's kind of a creep in some ways in this. But I think if you went to watch this because you really liked that time of like mod London 60s, and you would get a lot out of it, because you're getting that so much, and just cute, you know, Jane Birkin and Vanessa Redgrave, and it's just such a scene.
Yeah.
And you really get that. It's kind of like, it's just not really our thing. Like, it's like how we enjoy Once Upon a Time in Hollywood so much. And it's like not a whole heck of a lot happens there. It's just living in that world. So I, you know, with other, we were kind of talking about French New Wave and things like that. I can totally get into that if I know that that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
I'm going to enjoy the ride. But like you said, if you're going into this expecting some like really captivating, you know, thriller of trying to, you know, figure out, unravel some murder mystery, that's so not happening here. And at the end, it even kind of says, like, did it even happen? Kind of. I mean, it's leaving a lot of things up to, I think, interpretation.
Yes.
Because he's, you know, he's an unreliable narrator as well, because he's kind of drunk the entire time.
Sort of.
I mean, he's not drunk, falling down drunk, but he's drinking the entire time, like from morning until night, because that's his, you know, he can just kind of go and shoot pictures, and he wants to be a real photographer. He's like over fashion, and, you know, that's what he's out there doing, capturing this couple who's like canoodling in the park, and they don't want to have their picture taken, Vanessa Redgrave, and he's just like such a dick about it.
And we don't even really find out why. I mean, it's assumed that the man she's with is married, or maybe she's married.
Something is not good there.
Right. But then he figures out through this sort of laborious sequence where he keeps making blow-ups
yes.
of his photographs that they were looking at a dead body over in the corner, which is a huge leap anyway. And I mean, I know that anyone listening to this right now who's a fan of this kind of movie is probably groaning and you're not getting the point. It's not about that. It isn't about being an airtight, well-plotted piece of mystery suspense. It's like Antonioni just kind of took that idea and as a lark and like, oh, I'm just going to make this movie about how cool 1966 London is. And yeah, there'll be like a little bit of a murder mystery in there, but then it won't even really come to anything. And then we're going to end on mimes playing tennis.
That was what I was going to say. Like, I cannot not talk about the ending of this film. First of all, we see these mimes twice. We see them at the opening of the film, and they're the loudest mimes. They're going like it's like a circus clown car with all these mimes hanging out, and they're like, "Woo!" It's screaming, going down the road, not being mimes at all. And then at the end, we see them again, but then they go to this park, to the tennis court, and go into mime mode.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a tennis match between mimes, and it ends with the ball finally going over the tennis court, the imaginary mime ball, and David Hemmings like picks up the ball and throws it back to them. Yeah. The end.
And this is after David Hemmings has gone back to the park to look for the dead body that he found there the day before. And,
yeah.
Oh, it's not there anymore. Like, that's the end of the murder mystery.
That's the end of the mystery there. And the only like kind of thing that shows that he's tangled up in this is like his stuff gets rifled through in his apartment, his like studio apartment where he does his photo shoots. They like rifle through his film.
They being who?
They who? I don't know. So yeah, that's definitely was just like a little nugget of an idea. And it was more just about watching him live his life and enjoying this time period in London.
Yeah, and like wrestling with Jane Birkin and some other cute girl on like a sheet of like background paper that they use for photo shoots, and them trying on go-go outfits and giggling and
then all getting naked and I guess having sex in this photo paper. And they were just wanting these two young girls were just wanting him to take their pictures, and they were like, "You didn't take our pictures." And he was like, "Come back tomorrow."
He's like, "You ruined it."
Yeah, there's another photo shoot where he just tells all the models to close their eyes and he never comes back.
Yeah. He's a real dick.
He kind of is.
He's a real dick.
Yeah.
And in the whole movie, I'm like, am I supposed to think he's a dick or am I supposed to think he's cool? I kind of feel like I'm supposed to think he's cool, but I don't think he's cool. I think he's a dick.
I think that would have been considered cool at one point, but it's just, we're so evolved now.
I'm not that evolved.
I'm not that evolved either, but yeah, he's a dick.
I was a young man in the 90s. We behaved poorly sometimes. I'm not adverse to that kind of thing.
Sure, but this is like, he's operating on another level. But I think we're supposed to believe, because he's like this shit hot photographer, that he can just like treat people however he wants.
Yeah.
Anywho, that's Blow Up.
That's Blow Up. Sorry for spoiling that for you if you haven't seen it, but I honestly don't feel that you can spoil a film that is as plotless and it's really about the vibe.
Yeah.
See it for the mimes.
See it for the mimes.
But anyway, after watching that, we rewatched Blow Out.
That's right.
And man, what a cold, refreshing drink of water watching Blow Out after Blow Up is like, I just really enjoyed it even more. I mean, I think seeing Blow Up beforehand helped, but I've always liked the movie. Mm-hmm. But this time, I really, really enjoyed it. As we said, I am a fan of De Palma, as you are. I mean, De Palma of the last 20 years, not so much.
Well, that's why I said I'm a fan up to a point.
Yeah. I mean, I think in his heyday, he was pretty much hard to beat. I mean, he's one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite filmmakers.
Well, actually, this movie is Quentin Tarantino's favorite De Palma film. And this is why he cast John Travolta for Pulp Fiction.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, I was reading that because the irony there is that the reason we have Blowout on this show is because it didn't do well. And it kind of affected John Travolta's career. So the irony being that a film that, you know, didn't do his career much justice would end up reviving his career as he's cast in Pulp Fiction.
That's why it's always worth it to do the thing.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Even if you don't think the thing did what you wanted it to do for you, it's always worth doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it's, you know, something horrible and ends up with, you know, people dying or something. Then you shouldn't do the thing.
Then don't do the thing.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about kind of the conception of this, because as we said, it's kind of a loose remake of Blow Up, but the difference here is that instead of photography, the way that our hero, here played by John Travolta, and I think very well done by John Travolta.
I think he's great in this. I really enjoy this time of Travolta, and I think he's totally believable in this role.
Yeah.
He's playing a sound person.
Yes.
An audio engineer, I guess.
He's not an engineer. What he is he's a guy that goes out and gets sound effects for movies, specifically low rent horror movies, which, okay, right there, you're winning my heart, right? Two things. First of all, I am something of a sound aficionado myself. Obviously, we have a podcast. I produce and edit the podcast all myself, just in case anybody was wondering. And I'm a musician. I've done a lot of recording. I've been into sound for a long time. And in fact, I even went to recording school, and I got into foleying. Is basically what he does. They do foleying in the studio too. They recreate noises and stuff in like a studio environment. But he will go out into the field and actually record sounds and stuff like that. I mean, there are a lot of sort of famous guys that do something like that. Like Ben Burtt is the guy that did all the sounds for the Star Wars movies, which are, you know, really well done and really creative. The sort of things he did to get like the laser beam sounds and the spaceship sounds and all that. So it's like a, you know, it's a career that you can have. I find it really interesting, and I really love the fact that he's working for horror movies. The Chekhov's gun of this movie is a scream.
Yes.
Because in the beginning of the movie, we're watching this slasher movie. It's set up to look like we're actually watching a slasher movie, which is great.
I was going to say, we have to talk about the opening of this, because that's how it starts. It's like going, you know, the killer's point of view and going to all of these windows in this sorority or dorm or whatever. And we're seeing like a couple screwing around. We're seeing, of course, you know, girls in their 90s dancing to disco music, and another girl getting pissed because she's trying to study, and, you know, all of this stuff going on in the killer's POV. And then we end up, of course, in the shower. There's lots of boobs everywhere because it's a schlocky horror movie.
Yep.
And then we go into the shower scene, and he pulls back the curtain and he goes to kill her. And it's this, I mean, everything's great up until then. It's working. And then this like ridiculous scream happens. It's so bad.
And then we cut to the screening room where they're watching this, and the sleazy director, producer, or whatever is like, that scream's terrible. And like John Travolta's just kind of laughing at how bad it is. But this is going to be the sort of thing that he's tasked with. Not throughout the movie necessarily, but it's setting up this that he needs to get a scream, which is going to come back really kind of poignantly at the end. However, what I love about this whole scene is it's, first of all, it's very De Palma. It's reminiscent of Carrie, the opening to that, the way we're sort of getting this glimpse into this world. You know, Dressed to Kill has sort of a similar setup. It's also very Halloween, clearly referencing that movie. And, you know, and it's all a laugh. It's all like, you know, a fake slasher movie. But I just love it as an opening scene.
I love it, too. And I'd totally watch that slasher movie.
Yes.
But yeah, this is what tasks our hero, John Travolta. His name is Jack Terry in this, because the director producer guy is also complaining about the wind. He's like, that wind is terrible.
Yeah.
So he's going to go out into the wild and get some wind on tape.
Side note, we've been watching a lot of spaghetti westerns lately, and spaghetti westerns are all Foley. They don't do any on-set recording. So everything you hear in a spaghetti western and an Italian giallo, which this movie takes a lot from Italian giallos as well, all the sounds are fake, and I notice that there's a wind sound that you hear a lot, and you hear it in horror movies mm-hmm. in the 70s too, like Let's Scare Jessica to Death mm-hmm. has a lot of this wind sound in it, but it's like a very specific library wind sound. So I get it, the way the director or whatever is like, get me something that sounds real, like that is a thing. It does sound fake.
Yeah, because he says, he's like, I just got the one we use all the time from the library yeah. or whatever. And he's like, no, get me something that sounds better than this.
This nerdy shit, I just love it. No, I love all of this stuff.
I know you do. I even turned to you during the film last night and I was like, you are enjoying this on so many levels right now. This is your sweet spot of audio nerdiness.
Yes. And it's great. John Travolta goes out into this park to get some sounds. And this is, you know, a reference to Blow Up, because the character in Blow Up also goes out to a park and is taking pictures, and that's what's going to create the inciting incident, which happens an hour into the movie in that movie.
But in this movie, 12 minutes in.
That's right.
You made note, you were like, 12 minutes in.
Yeah, we have our inciting incident 12 minutes in, as opposed to 54 minutes or whatever it is in Blow Up. We should say that this movie takes place in Philadelphia, which yeah. is unusual, because Philadelphia isn't known for having a big movie industry. Maybe it did at one point, but I'm not aware of that. I mean, I think Pittsburgh had a little bit of one, which is where Romero comes from. Mm-hmm. De Palma said it in Philadelphia because he grew up there, and okay. that's where he wanted to shoot okay. it. I don't think there really is much of an industry there. However, you know, it's believable that there would be like a low budget horror company there. And it's cool. We go into the offices of this low budget horror production company, and there's like posters for Squirm and The Boogeyman and a bunch of like low rent late 70s, early 80s horror movies, if you're a fan of those.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the studio like kind of in like a real seedy part of town? Wasn't it like yes. the adult bookstore, like Peep Show, like yeah. next door? Yeah, sure. Like 25 cents and all that, like dances and all that stuff. Yes. Yeah, it's like the kind of the red light area.
So what happens is John Travolta is out in this park, and he's got his cool like boom mic, which he uses to pick up sounds, and it's, you know, very directional, so he can hear things like far away. At one point there's this couple who's sort of canoodling. He catches their conversation mm-hmm. on the mic, and they're like, that guy is watching us or whatever, which is also, I think, a reference to Blow Up.
Totally
similar sort of situation. And he's listening to an owl, mm-hmm. which Annie really enjoyed.
She sure did.
She liked the owl. And then he directs his mic towards a street, and this car comes down the street, and there's a tire blowout, and the car goes through a fence and into this river. And John Travolta jumps in heroically, mm-hmm. unlike the hero of Blow Up, who never does anything heroic.
Yeah, immediately. We commented on that as well. Like, immediately when he sees this happen, he, like, throws his recording stuff down, which is some nice equipment as well. And he's just, like, not even concerned, because he's a good guy, and dives right in to go see if he can help.
I always enjoy underwater car rescues in movies, and I think this is a pretty good one, because he sees the Nancy Allen character, Sally, I believe her mm-hmm. name is, in the car. He also sees there's this other older man in there, but he's like bleeding mm-hmm. and he's not gonna live. Mm-hmm. And he can't get the door open, so he like picks up a rock yep. off of the river bottom and smashes through the window. It's a pretty intense scene.
It's totally intense, and especially for poor Nancy Allen, because apparently she's claustrophobic, and this was really hard for her to shoot like this.
Oh, I can believe that.
Yeah, so the terror was real.
I'm sure it's terrifying to be in one of these scenes mm-hmm. where you have to be in a car. I mean, I know it's probably in a tank somewhere, sure, and there's a lot of safety scary. Protocols, but yeah. I don't want to be in a flooding car.
No, thanks. We should also mention, because this was something else that we commented on, you did as well, about the exposition, because this is going to come into play. When he was back at his studio before heading out for the evening, the TV's on, and we're hearing that in Philadelphia, this is a big celebration for the Liberty Bell and all of this going on, you know, so we're getting like there's this big event that's going to be happening in town. And we're also hearing about this governor who they had done a poll for, and if the governor's running, going to run for president. And the poll was if, you know, he had to vote today, who would you vote for? And the governor came like way ahead of the existing president.
Incumbent president.
Yes, the incumbent president. Yeah. So that's kind of just all happening in the background while he's like gathering his stuff to go out. And then we have this incident happen. And next, after he does get Nancy Allen out, we cut to the emergency room. And, you know, he's getting kind of interrogated by this cop. John Travolta is like not having it. He's like, I saved her life. Like, where is she? You know, and they're just like kind of giving him a hard time. And we come to realize that she was in the car with this governor.
Right. And now this governor is dead. Yes. So we're immediately getting the idea that there's going to be some sort of cover-up attempt. Mm-hmm. Because then this, you know, politician,
yeah,
not exactly sure who he's supposed to be, but he talks to John Travolta and he's like, can't you just say you didn't see the girl or whatever? Basically wants to make it seem like this was just an accident. There was no suspicious girl with this guy. He was married. That's not his wife.
Right.
So we're going to cover this all up so we don't make him out to be this, you know, sleazy politician who's now dead. And John Travolta is kind of not wanting to go along with this, but he's also just kind of like, fine, whatever, you know. Now, one thing I would want to mention about the scene that we were talking about and the way that exposition is delivered, what I love about it is that exposition is delivered with split screen. Mm-hmm. And De Palma famously likes to use split screen. Mm-hmm. And split screen can really seem like a gimmick, but I never feel like it's a gimmick with him.
I don't either. And I love it. I love it every time he uses it.
Yeah. And it's like, you get what's going on. Mm-hmm. And what's so smart about the way he films it is like John Travolta is just kind of like editing together mm-hmm. pieces of tape.
And labeling them.
So we're seeing what he does and we're getting an understanding of that. But then we're also getting the exposition because the split screen is showing us what's going on the TV.
That's
which
right.
He's not even paying attention to.
Mm-mm.
So we're getting the scene from two angles and we're getting this information that we need. We're seeing how he works and we're getting this like set up for the story.
That's right.
And I think that's just really great storytelling and filmmaking, and it gets you there so much quicker.
I think it's so like brings you up to speed with, you know, everything you need to know
at that
time to like go forth with the story.
I'm surprised more people don't use it. It's sort of fallen out of favor for whatever reason, and I think it's mostly because filmmakers don't know how to use it properly. The way you have to use it is you have to have one thing that you don't need to fully pay attention to, but you just kind of get, and then the other thing that you need to focus on more, and that way you're getting two things at mm-hmm. once, but you're not even really realizing it. And I think that's really clever filmmaking.
Yep. Well, De Palma does it best. He knows what he's doing.
Let's talk about Nancy Allen, because this is sort of where we get to know her character a little bit. She's, you know, in a daze at the hospital. And John Travolta, he's already suspecting some sort of foul play mystery here, because he recognized that there was actually two sounds.
Mm-hmm.
There was a gunshot,
mm-hmm.
and then there was the blowout of the tire. But they happened so close together that an untrained ear wouldn't notice it. They would have just heard the tire blowout,
mm-hmm.
which, again, I think is a really clever thing that, like, a guy who does sound would notice. Like, he knows it's two sounds, and even the one guy he talks to at one point is like, it's just an echo, and he's like, I know what an echo sounds like. It's not an echo.
Well, yeah, he's telling that to the cop or something, and you know, he's like, I do this for a living. I know what's what, and so it's perfect. It's believable that the sound guy knows his shit.
Yeah, I just love it in movies where we have a character who is really good at something and
is an expert.
Right. And that plays into it. And I especially love it when it's not something that you see all the time, you know, like, oh, I'm a scientist, so I know science stuff. Like, that's boring. Like, give me a story where like a musician knows something and that's how you figure out the mystery or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, making your protagonist an expert at something unusual and having the story center around that, I think, is a good recipe for a compelling story, and especially in a mystery.
I agree.
So how do you feel about Nancy Allen in this movie? Her
character? I love her. I was telling you as we were watching the movie last night, I was like, I just love Nancy Allen. And she's kind of doing a little bit of a, you know, an accent in this.
Yeah.
She's just so cute. And she just is endearing. And she's kind of, you know, a little all over the place and kind of a mess. And she is really into doing makeup, but she, you know, works at this makeup counter and she wants to do it for movies someday. That's her dream.
Yeah, she's kind of a hot mess. Mm-hmm. Now, I do feel that Nancy Allen can be kind of hit or miss sometimes. I think sometimes she can be just kind of a little too, I don't know how to put it. Sometimes I'm just not totally buying her. Like, I mean, in Poltergeist 3, for instance.
Well, yes.
In some of the RoboCop sequels, she's not so great. But I do like her a lot in Carrie.
Yep.
And I do like her a lot in this. And I do like her a lot in Dressed to Kill.
Agreed.
Famously, she and Brian De Palma were together at this point.
They were married.
Yeah. I don't think the marriage lasted.
No, this was, I think Blowout was 1981. I think they separated in 84.
You know, De Palma said that he didn't really intend to put her in all these movies, and he felt self-conscious about the fact that they were together, and he was like, oh, yeah, I'm putting my wife in my movies kind of thing. He had a little shame about it, unlike, say, Rob Zombie. But she's great.
Yeah.
In all three of his movies. So whatever they had worked, yeah. Like their relationship, he really knew how to direct her well, because I think she's done her best work with him.
I agree.
And I like her character in this movie. Let me ask you this, because this is something I was kind of struggling a little bit with this movie. John Travolta basically kind of starts really actively pursuing her. Like, first she wants to get out of the hospital, but she's so messed up that, mm-hmm. you know, from being concussed or whatever.
Well, they sedated her. She wasn't concussed. They sedated her because she was in shock.
Right. And so, you know, at first he's like, no, you need to stay here. But then I think once he starts to piece together the fact that there's something kind of like sketchy going on here, then he's like, okay, you can stay at my place. Or do they stay at a hotel or something?
They go to a motel.
They go to a motel. And then after that, he starts to sort of more actively pursue her. Is this because he has feelings for her, or is this because he needs her to get to the bottom of this mystery?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think he needs her to get to the bottom of the mystery, but he's also, because he's a decent guy, I think he's also concerned for her safety, because he knows people are going to be coming after her because they don't want this to get out that she was in the car.
Yeah.
The politician that talked to them at the hospital, whatever, has given her money to leave town for a while.
Yeah.
And he knows, and she thinks like, well, yeah, I'm just going to leave town for a bit. And he was like, you may not ever come back again. Like, he knows, which we learn more about him later, like what the reality of the situation is. And she's a loose end.
Yeah.
So I think he's worried about her genuinely. And I think he's, you know, spending more time with her and pursuing her because he wants to get to the bottom of this mystery. But in turn, with doing that, he's kind of crushing on her as well, because right. she's super cute and she's charming.
Yeah.
And I think, yeah, inadvertently, he's starting to have more feelings, more so than, you know, maybe even just trying to protect her.
Because all great protagonists need to have some sort of tragedy in their backstory. We're going to find out that his is that at one point in his career, he was working for the police and he was setting up wires mm-hmm. for people to wear. And this one guy was involved with the mob and he set up a wire for him. And the guy got in a car with some mobsters and he got so nervous that he was sweating so badly that he was causing the battery in the wire unit to overheat and mm-hmm. like burn into his mm-hmm. stomach. And John Travolta and the cops were sort of tailing this car, and John Travolta can tell, because the device is shorting out, the listening device is shorting out, and he figures out what's going on. And the guy tells the mobsters to pull over because he's got to use the bathroom. They pull over into this alley and the guy ends up hung in the bathroom. The mobsters figure out that he was wearing a wire.
Well, yeah. And he's hung by the wire.
By the wire.
Yeah. Really. And like they kind of like expose, you know, the wire on his chest and everything. Like it's very much like you're a rat.
Yeah.
It's really terrible because he can listen to all of this happening and just feel so powerless because he's trying to get there. And he's the guy in the car is like, you can't, you're going to blow this. And he's like, I can't, they're going to know that he's got a wire and all this stuff. And it's just pretty brutal because John Travolta is the one that discovers him.
I just think it's clever that this is the thing that went wrong in his life, that he was using his audio skills to try to, you know, help the police, essentially, and it ended up backfiring. Now, we both watched the show The Wire.
We watched it more than once, and I'm ready to watch it again.
Yes, which is all about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, I think there's a little bit of creative license here because I don't think it's actually like sound guys that work on these units. The police themselves learn right. how to use them. It's not that complicated.
I'm giving it some leeway, though, because of the time. It could have been something that they only had like a specialist for, because I was also appreciating like how far we've come technologically speaking with this type of thing, like how this would never happen. You would never have something you could sweat all you wanted and you would not burn up from, you know, being mic'd in some way now. And also just appreciating the fact of like John Travolta having to run around, you know, with these headphones on and also like this device that's like got a handle on it, you know, when he's like trying to listen in. And I will let it have that they needed a quote unquote expert to do that back then. Whereas now, it's just, as we know from The Wire, it's, you know, technologically advanced, so to speak, and anyone can listen.
I'm not dinging it for this. I think it's clever. I think it's cool. So that's what he's trying to sort of overcome, this guilt of this, you know, failure he had in his life, where it resulted in somebody dying because of his expertise. This is, of course, is going to play later in the movie. Let's talk a little bit about the weird conspiracy and John Lithgow.
John Lithgow is so great, and you nailed it because you had said if they remade this movie, John Lithgow's character would totally be played by Michael Shannon, and he would, because he's such a great weirdo in this. And he, I mean, I love John Lithgow. I mean, he has such a range.
He does.
You know, he can be, I was thinking about him after we had watched this. I was like, gosh, he can be so charming and funny and, you know, quirky, and he can be scary. Like, you know, what is Raising Kane, and, you know, there's other films where he's just kind of terrifying.
Well, it's not only that, he can be terrifying in so many different ways.
Yes.
Like, this creep is a different creep than the creep in Raising Kane. Even when he plays psychos, he does it different every time.
Yeah.
Like, this is a very specific Michael Shannon type of psycho. We find out, which is hilarious, that he was the one who shot
the tire,
right? But he wasn't supposed to kill the candidate or whatever. And he's taken it upon himself to, like, take care of all the loose ends.
No, he is, like, such a, like, he's so gone rogue. Like, they hired him for this one thing because, as it gets revealed to us, we get to know Dennis Franz, who was also at the scene, who, you know, randomly was there with his high-speed camera. And Dennis Franz sells his photos of the accident, and, like, they're all over the place. And, you know, kind of wondering, why was Dennis Franz there? Well, what we learn is Dennis Franz is a creep of his own kind, of such a creep in this. We should really give some credit to, like, his living in the flop house and his stained
wife beater
and just drinking JB right out of the bottle and just grosser than gross. And he does it so well. He's so great. But his whole thing that he's been doing with Nancy Allen to make extra dough is, like, get men into compromising positions. And she's not sleeping with them, but she's getting them, like, into bed or where it just looks bad. And then he busts in and takes pictures. So they hire John Lithgow to, like, make this accident happen, but it was only supposed to, like, not go off a bridge into the water, but it was supposed to be an accident so then Dennis Franz could, like, get them in the car together, get photos of it. But it just went all AWOL because, and like Michael Shannon, very much like his Michael Shannon's portrayal in Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah.
I think of that character where he's, like, such a psycho and such a creep, but also it's funny, like, because John Lithgow, like, the guy has no control over him. He's talking to him. John Lithgow's wearing like this Pacific Bell or whatever, like a phone company type hard hat outfit where he's, you know, out working on phone lines or something. He's a lineman for Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And he's talking to the politician that we have seen earlier, and he just can't control him. He's like, yeah, well, I decided to do this and that, and, you know, and then the hooker, I'm going to take care of her too and make it look like the Liberty Bell killer. And like,
he concocts a serial killer persona just so it will look like there's a killer on the loose, so when he murders Nancy Allen, it'll just seem like another one of these killings. I mean, clearly he's taking pleasure in it himself. He's got this Garrett watch that, like, he can pull out this strangle wire from his watch, but he's so kind of like fastidious and organized about it. And, you know, he makes fake phone calls to set up things through his, like, work as a lineman. And it's just such a quirky and cool villain performance.
It's so great. He's the best and worst person for this job. Like, you've, like, gotten someone who's really gonna see it through, but they're taking it to, like, it's completely, like, it's derailed. This politician doesn't know what to do because he can't control him. He's like, I didn't know, like, you didn't ask you to do this or whatever. And he's just, like, running with it. He's gonna take care of all the loose ends
in the most psychotic possible way. But it's funny because I sort of forgot that he was the villain in this, and then when he showed up, I was kind of like, oh, so we're going to get another John Lithgow as the villain. But then, nope, this is a completely entertaining and fascinating different take on a character. And he's just great in it. He's so much fun to watch. And man, it gets crazy near the end.
It gets so crazy. Well, we get more of John Travolta's character, Jack. He buys one of the magazines that all of the accident photos have been published in, which is just so creepy. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing that would happen. And he painstakingly cuts them out and, like, is basically creating his own negatives, so to speak, like a little picture book.
He's creating his own Zapruder film, essentially, because they published, like, frame by frame shots of this accident, which is ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous.
But it's fun.
But it's totally fun. And I do believe that it could happen. I mean, like, I think people are hungry enough to want to see, like, what exactly play by play happened. So yeah, we're seeing, like, every frame, because Dennis Franz had this super high speed camera. So he goes and cuts them all and, you know, creates a movie out of it with his sound.
He takes it to the police, and the police sort of hate him because...
They hate him because they think he was putting good cops away, is what the guy said.
That's right. This guy that ended up getting killed was informing on the police, right?
And he was a dirty cop.
So yeah, he brings it to this cop, and the cop's basically brushing him off and telling him, you know, all right, I'll look at your stupid movie or whatever. But he's not being very helpful. So he's not getting any help from the police.
No, the guy was like, I'll look at your movie because I'm good at my job. He was like, but I don't want to help you in any way because you were putting good cops away or whatever. And I don't think he gave the movie to the cops. I think he just had the sound or something like that. But we didn't see that had been another thing that John Lithgow had done, was he demagnetized all that stuff.
Yes.
So everything, basically all the evidence, except for some that he's hidden away, has been stripped. Like, he went through his office and, like, demagnetized everything.
Right. And basically all he has now is this film that he's put together. But
right.
What I liked about this, he ends up showing this to Nancy Allen at one point. He knows he can't use this as evidence because he's like, they'll think I just made it in the studio. And I'm glad that they addressed that, because that was one thing that I was thinking while I was watching. And I'm like, what is this going to prove? He's a sound guy.
Right.
He could have made all this stuff up. All you have to do is discredit him, which is sort of true for the whole movie. And I was thinking about it, if you tried to remake this today, or say you did it with a different medium, like say it's a special effects guy, it would be so hard to maintain any sort of believability throughout the story, because everything can be faked now. You know, now we've got AI that can fake everything. Like, nobody's going to believe that you have some sort of smoking gun sort of proof anymore, because it's all so easily faked.
Right.
But at this time, you know, I think it would have been more believable. One thing I wanted to talk to you about, though, is, like, we've been talking about how John Travolta's character is, you know, much more sympathetic than the character in the Antonioni film. However, in this middle section, as he sort of becomes more sort of frustrated with the way things are going, he kind of becomes more of a jerk. I mean, he's really being pushy to Nancy Allen, and his character does kind of become more of an asshole in the middle of the movie.
Yeah, but I think that's because he's just super stressed and run down and like desperate. And he's so desperate, like, because of what happened when he was working with the police. You know, he's so focused on like that somehow by making this right, it's going to get, you know, right the wrong that happened before or something like that. I feel like he gets really obsessed because of that.
Yeah, it's just an interesting sort of character arc, because I think what we're supposed to feel is his obsession at this time.
Yes.
And I think this was a very kind of common, like, things for characters to go through. You know, you go back to Rear Window, you know, Jimmy Stewart's character in that becomes obsessed mm-hmm. in the middle of the movie. And that's where we're supposed to feel as an audience is like, okay, is this really worth it? You know, this sort of madness that he's descended into. And I think Travolta does a really good job.
Well, yeah, I agree. And I think it's also that just everyone keeps calling him like a crackpot and stuff like that as well, like the cops. And like, no, I think it's just the fact that like nobody believes him. They're calling him like a conspiracy theorist. And yeah. You know, why does everything have to be a conspiracy? It was just an accident. And so that's where he's really kind of spinning out. And as far as his performance goes, I agree. I think he does this really well. And apparently he was suffering from insomnia during this shoot. So it really helped with him like being kind of manic.
I do think it's interesting that the attitude this movie takes on conspiracy theories like is kind of forward thinking. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're definitely, I think, in a stage of society where we're really skeptical about people and their friggin' conspiracy mm-hmm. theories. And this movie, you know, if you think about it, you know, after Nixon and all Watergate and everything, conspiracies came to light and people were probably very conspiracy minded around that time. You get a lot of political thrillers and movies around that time, like 3 Days of the Condor mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. So I appreciate that this movie takes the sort of attitude of like, does everything got to be a conspiracy? And in this case, it is. However, the conspiracy is just one guy going rogue. And I think that's probably true of a lot of conspiracies. Like, yeah, it's not really a conspiracy.
It's not that deep.
Yeah.
It's not as deep as we create it, or it gets to be created bigger, where it is just like one person who went off script. Also with Lithgow, we forgot to mention, John Travolta says to the cop, like, did you check the tire? Like, because nobody's believing that the tire was shot. And he's like, I heard it. You know, it's like somebody shot the tire and then, you know, it would blow out and they went off the bridge or whatever. And we do get a scene with John Lithgow going to where the car has been taken to. And it's, you know, up on the whatever the thing at the mechanic. And he brings a tire and he, because there's a bullet hole in the tire that's there. So that's another loose end that he's tied up. He tells the politician, he goes like, I switched out the tire. So even if they go to check the tire, I mean, he really did. He's very thorough. They do. If they go to check the tire on the car, it looks like it just was blown out. There's not a gunshot there.
Yeah.
A bullet hole.
Yeah. He's covering up all the loose ends.
He really is.
Again, if you're a fan of De Palma, you'll know that one of his primary themes is voyeurism. And this movie, there is a lot of shots where mm-hmm. we see, you know, we're looking at John Travolta through a window, like when he's hiding things in his apartment.
Right.
He's got like a drop ceiling and he puts stuff in there. You know, we see a lot of shots through windows and stuff like that. That's a very common De Palma motif. Mm-hmm. I do appreciate that in this movie, though, we get the added element of listening in.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is a film that I've never watched, but we should watch at some point. Coppola's The Conversation.
Mm.
There's a lot of references to that. That apparently has a lot to do with listening in and that kind of audio surveillance. I like that we're getting this added element to Palma's arguably creepy fetish about voyeurism. But yeah, so if those are the things you like in De Palma, you get plenty of them here. So yeah, we're building up to this climax, which is sort of built around this idea that there's this kind of sleazy news reporter who is going to break the story wide. He believes Travolta. He's the only guy that's really listening to him, but he's kind of a scumbag. However, somehow the John Lithgow character, because he has access to all the phone lines, intercepts this drop that's supposed to happen at a train station. And he's cut John Travolta's phone off so that he's not receiving calls, even though the phone's still working. He's contacted Nancy Allen as this news reporter, even though obviously he's not. But John Travolta doesn't realize that. He thinks that she's going to meet the reporter. Or does he believe that?
John Lithgow, because he's got the equipment, he listens in, first of all, to the phone call between the reporter and John Travolta. So he knows what's happening there. And John Travolta has agreed that they're going to meet. He's going to give him the tape because the reporter says it will only work if you come on air and say what has happened. He also wants Nancy Allen to go. And John Travolta's like, no, she doesn't want to be involved. It's not safe for her, but I'll go. And so the reporter's like, great, I'm in the middle of something. I'll call you back. John Lithgow cuts the phone line. So when the reporter's calling back, the phone's busy. And then Nancy Allen gets the call. And we've already established earlier, because John Travolta says something to Nancy Allen about the reporter, and she was like, oh, I don't watch the news.
Right.
So she has no idea who this guy is.
Yeah.
So he calls and says all this stuff. And, you know, like, I guess he wants to meet her and get the tape from her. And so she goes over to John Travolta's place and she's like, where have you been? I've been trying to call you. And he's like, my phone. And he picks up his phone and it has a dial tone, but Lethgal's done something. So his phone is appearing to be busy. So she says, he called me. And John Travolta says, how did he get your number? She goes, oh, you know, reporters are good at figuring that stuff out. So I think John Travolta's a little suspicious. Mm-hmm. Also just suspicious, thinking that something's going to happen to the tape or whatever. So she's supposed to go meet him at the train station. And so John Travolta wires her. And he's like, I'm going to be close in case anything happens. And, you know, don't give him the tape right away. Like, try to just talk to him for a while. And, you know, I think he just feels uneasy about, because this is all he's got, you know. And so he does also make a copy of it, which was smart.
Yes.
And Nancy Allen's like, you're being paranoid or whatever. And he's paranoid for a reason, though.
I mean, obviously, this is a setup so that we're going to have this really great suspense climax in which Nancy Allen is wearing a wire and she's with John Lithgow, who we know is a psycho. And in fact, we get this whole sort of extended sequence where there's this prostitute in the train station giving like sailors blowjobs in phone booths. And John Lithgow just decides to kill her too.
Well, literally, because he's like, I've got time.
Right.
Like, he looks at his watch or the clock at the station and it's not quite five. It's like 4:45. So it's enough time to kill this poor prostitute.
His reasoning ostensibly is he's setting up more deaths so sure. that it'll look like there's a serial killer, which there is him.
Him. Yeah. The Liberty Bell killer. Like, he literally, like, I think he's stabbing like in the shape of a bell, like in their abdomens or yeah. something. With like an ice pick. It's, yes. That's so bizarre.
Right. He strangles them and then he stabs them with an ice pick.
In the shape of a bell.
It's just, I guess, an added murder scene. Maybe De Palma felt like sure. there wasn't enough murder.
It's fine. But he's like, yeah, I could squeeze this one in before I meet with Nancy Allen. And he's such a creep. Like, he totally, because he had listened in to the conversation, like, he is really talking like the reporter. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's pulling it off. As far as like that type of persona, I think we know as the audience, we know this is terrible. And he starts, you know, taking her down to the subway, and poor John Travolta's listening and panicked and starts running after them because he can tell.
Yeah, he's trying to use whatever audio cues he can to figure out where they're going. And at one point, Nancy Allen says, like, oh, we're taking that train.
Yeah, the Franklin Bridge,
right.
something.
And so he knows how to go there. Look, I'm loving all of this. I just love this as a suspense sequence. And this is De Palma at his best mm-hmm. doing this kind of suspense. I don't quite understand why John Travolta didn't just go with her and is like, no, I'm going with you to this drop.
Right.
He said to come alone. I'd be like, fuck that. I'm going with you.
Yes, exactly. Like, this is my thing. I would want to be involved. But
then the movie would be over because he'd be like, that's not the reporter.
Yeah. So, yeah, we have to take some liberties there.
I don't offer this as criticism. criticism.
No, I'm not offering that as criticism either. I love the movie, but yes, you're right. It would be the end.
These are the points in movies that are fun to point out because we understand that, like, logically you wouldn't do this, but then we wouldn't have this great climax for a movie. You've got to let go of these things with movies. Not everything can be airtight logic or else you don't get a fun movie experience. You know what, people? Movies aren't real. They're not real life. They're not supposed to be. You're just supposed to be entertaining and enjoy them as stories.
And as an escape from real life.
Exactly. You know, if there's too many stupid things, then that's another matter.
Yeah, but that's not the case here. You got to let some things go to make other things work.
Now, one thing I've forgotten totally about is how crazy this parade sequence that we get into is.
Oh, my God. I had forgotten this, too. I completely forgot. Like, how bananas this is. Like, John Travolta in his little Jeep just driving through the Liberty Bell parade madness.
It's insane. It's a little uncomfortable.
I know.
Because we've had a few incidents where crazy people have driven into parades.
Into crowds
and
stuff, yeah.
So unfortunately, it hasn't aged well in that way. However, in terms of filmmaking, it is like white knuckle. Like, yes. He's going through tunnels and there's people coming at him from the parade and he's like barely missing them. And it's pretty intense in terms of action filmmaking.
It's super intense and ends with him like driving into a storefront window.
Yeah.
And then knocks himself out.
Yeah.
And at this point, like, Nancy Allen's walking along with John Lithgow over to the big event with like fireworks going off. That's what he says. He's like, oh, we could go have a drink. John Lithgow says to Nancy Allen, we could go have a drink and watch some of the fireworks and, you know, talk and, you know, give me the tape or whatever. And so they walk out to kind of like this pier or something on the edge of the water. And he was like, oh, can I see the tape? Is it 16 or 35? And she's like, what? He's like, I just wanted to know for, you know, what kind of tape it is, you know, for
film.
Film for the network. And he pulls it out and he's like, oh yeah, it's, you know, it's 16 or whatever. This is perfect. And then he gets like the audio also. And then he starts like pulling it apart and wrapping. She's like, oh, you gotta wrap it up. Like, and he just chucks it into the water. And that's when she knows she's in trouble.
And he basically drags her up the set of stairs that's outside and he's going to kill her. And John Travolta's trying to get through the crowd.
Well, he comes
parade.
To in an ambulance.
Right.
Yeah. He's got a head injury. And he just like busts out of the ambulance, is running through this crowd. It's really intense. Like, I mean, I know what the outcome is. I've seen it before, but it's just, I was really on the edge of my seat. John Travolta's still listening. He can hear everything that's going on.
Yeah, he hears basically Nancy Allen being strangled.
Yes.
And, you know, there's fireworks going on. There's a great Pino Donaggio score,
yes,
which I really liked the score to this,
yes,
movie. And John Travolta arrives as John Lithgow is about to stab her with the ice pick. He stops John Lithgow from stabbing her, but unfortunately, she is already dead because he already used his
wire
strangle cord, yeah, on her. But before that happened, she screamed, and it was a really good scream.
It was a legit scream.
And at the end of the movie, he's back in the screening room because, like, the director's been hounding him this whole movie. Like, did you get me that scream? And there's funny scenes where he's trying out different women for the scream and no one can do the scream.
It's so terrible.
But John Travolta has the perfect scream now, and they use Nancy Allen's death scream,
yep,
in the movie. And you can tell John Travolta's character is just completely shattered.
Yep.
It's quite tragic, really.
It's a super bummer ending. I mean, it's well done. I don't mean like there's no other way you could do it. It's just sad.
I love it. I mean, I think it's just that kind of thriller noir.
Yeah.
It's very noir.
Yeah.
It just needs to be a downer ending.
That's what I'm saying. There's no other way you could do it. This is how it's supposed to be. But it's a bummer.
I love that goes right back to the beginning. Like, we need a scream,
yep,
and now we have it.
Now she's in movies forever.
It's a really good scream.
It really is.
So yeah, this movie was really high profile. I mean, for the time, it was quite expensive. I think it ended up costing about $18 million.
Wow.
And it bombed big time when it came out. Why do you think it failed?
I have no idea.
I have some theories.
Okay. I'm like, I don't know. I think it's a great movie. I don't know.
There's no smoking gun to point to here where I can say for sure what I think it is. I think there's a couple of things going on here. And I remember this because I was alive at the time, but there was kind of John Travolta backlash. I mean, he had been in Saturday Night Fever. He had been in Grease. Mm-hmm. He was in Welcome Back, Kotter. He was a huge, huge deal, like from 1978 to like 1980. He was just like the biggest star right. in the world. And I remember there being sort of this feeling of like, oh, John Travolta. And I think that just at this point, I think people just didn't want to really see a John Travolta movie. Mm. Like, I think they just assumed he was kind of this guy who did musical-oriented movies. And if you think about it, like, yeah, after this, there's what, Staying Alive or whatever. I mean, this is kind of the end of his first leg of his career. After this, he disappears for about 10 years. I mean, he doesn't disappear. He's in stuff, but he's not the star he was yeah. until we get to Pulp Fiction, and then he has this whole big resurgence in the 90s. But I just kind of feel like people were kind of cooling on John Travolta. I think they were just kind of like, I don't want to see that guy in a movie right now. And that's the only thing I can come up with, because the movie got really good reviews. Like, the critics really liked it. Right away, they were saying, oh, this is one of De Palma's best. You know, Dressed to Kill had done well the year before, so there was no reason to think like a movie like this wouldn't do well. And then like the whole neo-noir thing of the 80s happened too, which this fits in with those. Right. This is really one of those cases where it's like, what went wrong? I mean, maybe the marketing wasn't great, but I don't know. I think word of mouth was even good on it. I think it was just people weren't into John Travolta at that time.
Well, I mean, that makes sense as to why people didn't turn out to the theater, if that's what it was. I mean, he also had done, maybe right before this, I think it was 1980, it was Urban Cowboy as well.
Yeah, it was around that time.
Yeah, so there was a lot of big things.
I think it was overexposure.
Yeah.
I think that happens sometimes with celebrities. I think they just get too big too fast and they get kind of shoved down everybody's throats for a while. And people are like, you know what? I'm sick of seeing this person. I mean, I feel like that kind of happened with Jennifer Lawrence recently.
Yep.
And she wisely sort of recognized that and sort of scaled back on her projects. And she said that. She's like, I feel like everyone's getting sick of me. And I think they were. I think she was right to think that, because you can kind of see it in the media that yeah. it starts to become this like backlash against the person. And people start to look for faults and point out, you know, things they did that were unflattering or yeah. whatever they need to do to sort of create a narrative that this person isn't as great as you think they are.
Yeah.
And I think it's a real shame in terms of Travolta, because I think he was really kind of poised to show the world what a good actor he really was. You know, like the Grease character and the Saturday Night Fever character are different characters.
Absolutely.
He's clearly doing something different, but you know, you can kind of lump them together. Yeah, I think there was more to him, and I just think people didn't want to see it for whatever reason at that point. I think they were burnt down on John Travolta.
That's the only thing that would make sense.
He was a big deal for a while, but he was also associated with things that I think people kind of turned on, like disco. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
You know, because he was like the face of disco because of Saturday Night Fever. And then everybody was like, fuck disco.
People had turned on disco big time around this time. It was a big disco backlash.
Foolishly, I might add. I hope that everybody who hated on disco back then is sorry for what they did, because I'm a rock and roller, as everybody knows. And it was not cool to be into rock and roll and like disco. I mean, I was too young to have a real dog in that fight at the time. However, I like both of them. Rock and roll and disco are not that far apart.
I love disco. I love it so much. You know, I mean, we used to like put on disco Saturday night here.
Yeah. So yeah, if you hated on disco in the 70s, shame on you.
Well, look what we have now.
You'd kill for that disco now.
Kill for that disco now.
I sure would. All right. Well, you have anything else to say about Blowout?
No, not really. I enjoyed revisiting it, and I'll watch it again. It remains one of my favorite De Palma films. I think it's a great movie. I think if you like mysteries and neo-noir and you like John Travolta and Nancy Allen. I think this is one that you'll really enjoy.
Yes, and I'd like to thank Paul Natale for suggesting it.
Yes, thank you, Paul. And you other listeners, you can suggest things too.
That's right. Just let us know.
Just let us know.
It just has to be something that failed either financially or critically.
That's all it needs to be.
All right, well, I'm going to go drink some J&B scotch and go take some audio of people canoodling in the park and...
just see what happens?
Just see what happens. That about does it today for Tentpole Trauma. If you like what you heard, check out our social media presence on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Tentpole Trauma. That was easy, wasn't it? If you like us, hit subscribe and leave us a sterling review on iTunes, if you dare. If you really like us, head over to patreon.com and get involved in one of our fabulous tiers. You'll be glad you did. Want to communicate with Tentpole Trauma? Send an email to tentpoletrauma@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And who knows, one day you may even get your email read on one of our shows. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you real soon.